The ledge widened, and almost suddenly what had been shadow became substance. The narrow ledge had become the broad floor of a cavern. Beneath their feet was solid rock. Rourke once again took the burden of Sergeant Hines. Natalia carried one of his assault rifles and his musette bag. Sarah carried the second M16 and the canteen. They walked in ragged formation, four abreast, the going easier as well because the passageway slanted slightly downward.
We are at last out of the Whispering Gallery. Can any of you hear me?
Yes.
Rourke shifted Hines' weight on his shoulder. His neck and his back ached from the strain.
I hear you, but it sounds funny.
My ears are ringing. I can't stop it, but it doesn't seem as bad.
I think Hines may wind up the luckiest one, at least in that department. With his unconscious state, his auditory functions might have been better able to compensate for the noise level. How much further to the entrance of the complex?
Rourke was debating whether to stop and give Hines a more thorough examination now that space allowed, or continue until they reached the entrance.
Another 10 minutes, if that. And again, it would be wise to be silent since we are so close.
They walked on. The passageway narrowed as it turned sharply right and the angle increased downward. The end of the journey through the underground was near. He raised his left hand to his ear. Too faintly, he could make out the ticking of his Rolex. But at least hearing was returning. The passage took a sharp bend left and leveled off, and Mann ran ahead, raising his right arm in a signal to halt. Rourke stopped, Natalia on his right, boosting Hines's body slightly to ease the weight burden. Sarah started forward behind Mann, one of the three assault rifles she carried, two of her own and one of his, pointed along the rock corridor. Mann was feeling his hands along the surface of the rock at the end of the corridor. It seemed like a dead end from the distance, as Rourke observed him. But then suddenly the rock beneath Mann's splayed hands shifted outward. Mann drew his pistol and moved to the right side of the rock panel, then stepped through. Rourke watched Natalia's eyes for an instant, her incredible blue eyes. She smiled at him. They heard a sound and looked up. Two German soldiers appeared at the far end of the corridor. Sarah raised the assault rifle. Natalia wheeled toward the opening. But then Mann was there. He waved a hand to signal all was as it should be. The two German soldiers, their assault rifles slung at their sides, ran the length of the corridor, past Sarah, stopped beside Rourke, and took Hines from him.
There's been a break in the left leg at the shin, and the right arm is dislocated from the shoulder. Be careful how you carry him.
Yes, sir, Doctor.
Rourke flexed his tortured shoulders, walking ahead, taking one of his assault rifles from Natalia. Mann beckoned for them to come through the passageway as Rourke took the second rifle from Sarah. Rourke took the 800-round box of .223 Sarah was hefting and picked up the box Mann set beside the exit from the rock corridor. Then, ahead of his wife, ahead of Natalia, ahead of the two German soldiers carrying the injured sergeant, he passed through the cutout in the rock. During their 5 centuries of survival beneath the earth, the Germans perfected a system of fusion-based hydroelectric power. Rourke now stood in the midst of this vast power plant, pipes of enormous diameter all but obscuring the low ceiling, and the roar of turbines drowning out, at least temporarily, the roaring inside his head. He looked to right and left and could see no end to the corridor formed on one side and overhead by piping. Beneath his feet and on the wall behind him were concrete slabs. Mann stood a few feet away, his arms enfolding a tall, slender, patrician-looking woman who was, by any standard, exquisitely beautiful. Rourke noticed that Sarah, then Natalia, flanked him.
Ah, I can see why man kept going.
John Rourke, Sarah Rourke, Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, and Colonel Wolfgang Mann slipped away from the power plant and through the complex, hidden in 55-gallon drums. There was an empty fifth drum. Because of his injuries, it was impossible to cram Sergeant Hines inside the drum. He remained at the power plant, but only after a consultation with a military doctor satisfied Rourke. The power plant, like anything conceivably defense-related, was under the direct control of the Army. The officer corps was entirely SS, but like Wolfgang Mann, the substantial portion of the officer corps was SS in uniform and rank designation only. The power plant was controlled by Mann's people. Cramped in the drum with his weapons and gear, Rourke felt the jostling as a delivery vehicle ferried them. At a loading dock for what Mann identified as the New Fatherland printing office, Rourke, his wife, Natalia, and the Standartenfuhrer exited the drums and switched to a van. They hid their assault rifles beneath the floorboards and pulled on the enlisted rank uniforms provided for all of them. Rourke admired German precision, as the uniforms were near perfect fits.
Oh, say, looking good, ladies.
Natalia's and Sarah's women's uniforms, however well-fitting, were terribly unflattering. The two glared at Rourke. The windowless van stopped. Eva Mann stood waiting for them in a below-level parking area. As they ran from the van, at Eva's urging, to join her near what appeared to be a service elevator, Wolfgang Mann answered Rourke's unasked question.
High-ranking members of the officer corps and other ranking officials are permitted private vehicles. The air scrubbing system can only take so much here in terms of emissions, and electrically powered vehicles such as the van and the private cars are in limited supply, intentionally so to prevent traffic problems. You'll have a better understanding once you've seen the complex from our home.
Natalia, then Sarah, then John Rourke showered. His body clean, his hair washed, Rourke sat back in one of the two identical sofas across the table from Eva Mann and her husband. Wolfgang Mann sat with a towel across his neck, his bathrobe belted around him, hair wet from taking the last shower. Rourke wore clothes Eva Mann provided for him. Again, the fit was perfect. A dark blue cotton-knit turtleneck shirt, dark blue beltless slacks, and black fabric rubber-soled shoes. Beside him was a thin, black, waist-length Eisenhower jacket.
You look at ease here, Doctor.
Rourke smiled at the woman.
There's a saying, I suppose there's some equivalent in German, that looks oft-times deceive.
He studied her pretty face.
On the other hand, you don't seem at ease at all.
Across Rourke's shoulders was the harness of the double Alessi shoulder rig, the twin stainless Titanix 45s in place under each arm. He trusted the Mann's by now, but never considered himself foolish.
You are right, Herr Doctor.
She smiled.
This entire affair, it frightens me. For you were dressing, and Wolf was showering. Some distressing news came to me from another woman in the organization.
What, my darling?
Mann stood, took the towel from about his neck, and rubbed his wet hair in an attempt to dry it.
Helena Sturm. She has been arrested.
Mein Gott. But she...
Who is Helena Sturm?
Eva Mann ran her splayed hands along the tops of her thighs, stopping as her fingertips reached the hem of her dress.
She is very important. Besides me, she's the only one in the complex who knows the overall plan.
Oh, that's great. Drugs are available, I suppose, and other means to make her talk?
She is pregnant with child. They would not force her to reveal...
Wolf...
Eva Mann stood, her arms going around his neck, then her forehead touching at his chin.
They will use any means, regardless of the life she carries. Twins, perhaps. Perhaps you should break radio silence and notify her husband in the field.
She is a Nazi. I fear he loves the party more than his wife.
Mann kissed his wife's hair, then turned away from her and walked to the windows. The drapes hung partially open. Through the windows that formed almost the entire wall, Rourke could watch the complex. It was a city, but built entirely inside a mountain. The engineering required to cut a shaft of such huge proportions into the earth, to blast so precisely as to hollow out much of the inside of the mountain without bringing it down, was staggering to consider. But German engineering had been among the best in the world. He estimated the height of some of the buildings to be in excess of 20 stories, and the surface area covered perhaps 3 square miles, as best he could judge.
We have to get her out.
Precisely so, Herr Doctor. Precisely.
Get who out?
John Rourke turned to Sarah. He smiled. The last time he saw her in nylons and high heels had been, he remembered, their wedding anniversary, a few months before the night of the war. She wore a gray dress now, the skirt straight and to just below the knee, the neckline high and collarless, the sleeves reaching to her wrists. A string of pearls hung from her neck, and her hair was up, revealing pearl earrings.
You look beautiful.
She blushed.
Who do we have to get out?
She is beautiful, John.
Rourke turned to look at Natalia. Almost predictably, she wore black, the dress almost identical in design to the one Sarah wore, but with a waist-length jacket. A single gold chain encircled her neck. The gold earrings were her own, he recognized. The earrings showed when the wind swept her hair back or she tossed her hair. He saw them now, because like Sarah, Natalia's almost black hair was up.
Your wife, Herr Doctor, and your friend as well. They are most beautiful. I was right in assuming they would be able to pose as officers' wives or other women of the elite.
Rourke turned and looked at Eva Mann finally, but he said nothing.
Who is it that we must rescue?
Helena Sturm. She is one of the leaders of the organization that opposes the leader. She alone, besides us, of those inside the complex, knows the entire plan. And she is pregnant.
Her due date is very near.
John Rourke waited as Sarah and Natalia crossed the room, waited until they sat on the couch, then sat down, Sarah between Natalia and himself.
Do you know why she was arrested?
And where she has been taken?
Eva Mann wrung her hands, then sat, perched on the arm of the opposing sofa, her husband sitting beside her.
I fear her oldest son. She has three others, but I fear her oldest son, Manfred. He's a member of the youth. I fear that he betrayed her. If that is so, then I fear she will be under interrogation even now. Not at the detention center, but she will be at the new government hall. It was recently finished on the surface outside the complex.
Confirm what you can without arousing undue suspicion. Once we're certain where she is, then we go and get her.
Annie Rourke stopped trying to undo the ropes about her wrists. They were synthetic, triple-stranded, and so soft she couldn't have tugged the knot free, even if she could have reached it with her teeth. But she could not reach her hands, because after she was forced at gunpoint to the Soviet helicopter, Forrest Blackburn, skillfully, she admitted to herself, crossed her jaw with his fist. Her jaw didn't even hurt now, but when she awakened, the Soviet helicopter was airborne. Her wrists were bound in front of her, and the safety harness locked her arms to her sides and kept her shoulders in an upright position against the seat back.
Soviet technology's come a long way.
Annie could hear him through the headset he placed on her after she regained consciousness.
Paul will kill you for this if Michael or my father doesn't get to you first.
Yes, well, Annie. May I call you Annie? Well, your dear daddy is in Argentina. Your brother is flat on his back, just like poor Mr. Rubinstein. If I didn't kill the kike when I knocked him out, I don't think he'll be in much shape to come after us either. Captain Dodd seems to have his hands full, doesn't he? And I doubt he'll send off valued personnel and equipment to rescue a troublesome girl and track down the last of the Soviet agents. You know, I'll tell you something, Annie. Actually, you're better off. Stick with me and you'll live longer.
Fuck you!
I'm glad you brought that up. I intend for you to do just that, Annie. I haven't had a... Well, let's just say I haven't for 5 centuries. It's ridiculous, isn't it? 5 centuries? My goodness!
I'm glad you didn't say my God.
You may prove too much like your father and mother. And if you do, I'll be very sorry for you, Annie.
Where the hell are we going? To Karamazov?
No. The last man I want to see. Just now, anyway.
She looked above her at the rotors, then below through the chin bubble. The ground was rockier than it should have been, and ahead through the windscreen, she could see a blinding whiteness. They were heading north.
I thought Karamazov was your boss.
Her wrists were hurting her, and her fingers were falling asleep.
Well, he was. But I never did fully trust him, you know. 5 centuries ago. Jeez, that still amazes me.
She turned to watch him, smiling as if to himself. He was doing something with the controls of the Soviet machine. She thought he might be preparing to land, because through the chin bubble again, she could see the ground coming up fast beneath them.
But 5 centuries ago, when Vladimir Karamazov first began getting suspicious that there was something like the Eden Project, well, when he asked me to get involved, I wanted some assurances. Future welfare, you might say. One of the things I got, but not from him, because I don't know if he even knew about it, but I got the location of the underground city.
The what? Is this thing landing?
The underground city. It was a project my employers had going for some time before what your family calls the Night of the War. It was already self-sufficient back then. And yes, we are landing. One of the things Karamazov provided, and I spot-checked that he hadn't lied, were personal supply caches for me. Aircraft fuel sealed in hermetic containers that were rock-proof. Individual weapons and emergency food supplies. They were surprisingly inexpensive. He had 100 such little caches made for me throughout the continental United States, since there would be no way to foretell where the Eden Project might land. Do you know how long it takes to memorize 100 sets of compass coordinates?
At least Blackburn seemed like a competent pilot. They were clearly about to touch down, and the ride was smooth as silk. Annie had never touched silk until Natalia gave her one of the teddies she wore. Annie had not wanted to take it, yet wanted it very much. She wondered if she would ever get the chance to wear it. She looked at Blackburn.
Now, surely, Annie, you were thinking that with all that has happened, the magnetic coordinates will have changed. And you're right. But I took a reading off the Eden-1's instruments and then wrote down the map coordinates from memory and worked a compass correction formula. We're right on the money. You see, after I get the materials I need precisely located, I'll fly the machine closer if necessary and resupply. Then off we go to the underground city where I will be a hero of surrealistic proportions. And should anybody follow us and by chance intercept us before we get there, well...
Blackburn turned to look at her, pulling his headset off, then reached across and pulled off hers.
Ouch!
He had caught some of her hair in it. He reached to her hair and began to undo it from the headset.
Should we encounter difficulties, well, you're my hostage. If you're important enough to go after, you're important enough to be kept alive.
Her hair was free of the headset, and she shook her head to get her hair back from her face. Forrest Blackburn climbed down from the machine, taking the key for the thing with him, then walked around the front of the aircraft. Blackburn drew another piece of rope from his pocket and reached down to her ankles. He began binding them tight together. Then he drew them back under the seat and tied them to one of the seat stanchions.
Where do you think I'm gonna go?
Nowhere.
He wore a large lined and hooded jacket that looked like it was military once. He reached to her shoulders and wrenched the shawl free of her arms and then twisted it into a rope. He drew her head forward and bound the shawl over her mouth, between her teeth. She felt as if she would gag.
Now, nice and safe, Annie. And just so you start thinking along the right lines.
He unbuttoned her coat and pushed its skirts aside. Then he drew her skirt and her slip up along her thighs. He bunched her skirt and her slip up to her hips. The backs of her thighs grew cold against the vinyl of the seat. He reached under her clothes and found her underpants, then pulled them down along her thighs over her knees.
Get you cold enough, even you'll want a little warmth, Annie. Be back in a while.
He slammed the door. Humiliated, frightened, torn from her family, Annie gave in to tears. But there was something else welling up inside her. She felt its force behind her tears. Defiance.
Paul, answer me, damn it.
John?
No, Michael. What the hell happened?
He watched as Paul Rubinstein opened his eyes.
Michael?
They brought you in here unconscious. Something about Annie?
I told Michael he should not get out of bed.
I'm all right.
Michael leaned back on his perch at the edge of the cot where Paul Rubinstein lay. He had lain on his back since his surgery, and working his stomach muscles pained him. His back ached as well from where his father dug out some of the Soviet bullets. Michael Rourke eased back further, then stood to rid himself of the pain. He leaned against the center post of the tent, Madison beside him. She reached to support him.
I'm all right, Madison.
Paul was sitting up, propped on his right elbow, his face very pale.
What's going on, Paul? Dr. Munchen brought you in. He looked at me, too. He looked at Madison. He told her he was good at looking in a woman's eyes and telling if she were pregnant.
No one can do such a thing. But I do have life here.
She touched her abdomen. Paul shook his head, then sat up straight, his face showing pain. His right hand came from his hip pocket, a gleaming stainless steel derringer in it.
Munchen's a good guy. He knew I had this.
What's going on, Paul? Where's Annie?
Munchen didn't tell you?
What?
Annie, Forrest Blackburn, he's the Russian agent. He kidnapped Annie. Took a Soviet chopper and headed out. Dodd, I think it was him, said Blackburn couldn't get much more than 100 miles or so, not enough fuel. But he won't send anybody after her.
We can go. I can lie just as flat in the back of Dad's truck as I can here.
And I can drive this truck.
Michael Rourke put his arm around Madison's shoulders and drew her head against his chest.
You probably could.
Paul was sitting up fully now.
All right. This is what we do. I use this.
He gestured with the Derringer.
And we get ourselves John's truck. I left that spare high power I picked up at the place.
Paul smiled at Madison and then turned his face away.
Left that and some spare magazines and stuff in the truck, just in case. We know where the strategic stores are located. Blackburn doesn't. We can catch him after that fucking machine of his runs out of gas.
Madison will stay. I can drive.
Michael could barely stand.
Well, I don't think so, Michael. And your dad wouldn't leave Madison alone here without someone to protect her. And he wouldn't take off all shot up with another guy in pretty much the same way and leave the only healthy person behind.
Madison's pregnant, Paul.
Good for her. If this was 6 months from now, I'd agree with you. But it isn't, and I don't.
Michael eased down to his cot. Madison raised his legs, swinging his feet up onto the cot. Michael leaned back, straight, flat on his back, staring at the tent roof.
All right. You've got the experience I haven't.
Yeah, but you're a Rourke.
Michael turned away again, looking upward.
What do we do?
All right.
I can take the Derringer pistol, that is correct?
Yeah, but no, you can't.
Hear her out, huh?
Michael turned to look at her as she gathered up her shawl from the floor of the tent and cocooned it about her shoulders and upper body, then hugged her arms to her chest. She began to pace.
I can take Annie's pistol and go to Father Rourke's truck. If it is unguarded, I will drive the truck here. If it is guarded, I will do something so that it is not guarded any longer.
Madison stared at Paul a moment, then swept her hair back from her face.
I will return here, and Paul and I can help you, Michael, into the truck. We can then go to Captain Dodd and ask for the return of our guns. If he does not, well, then we shall steal them.
She nodded her head as if deciding something, and then she smiled.
Is this good?
Paul Rubenstein's face lit with a grin as Michael watched him.
You know, Michael, she may be a Rourke already.
Paul seemed to weigh the Derringer in his hand.
All right, Madison. This is an American Derringer Corporation 45 ACPOU Derringer. John, Father Rourke, as you like to call him. He showed me once how these big bore Derringers work. The trick is to make sure the firing pins are set, so the bottom barrel goes off first. That'll be your most accurate shot.
Yes, Paul.
John Rourke carried a briefcase. Many men in the complex carried similar briefcases, but John Rourke doubted the contents were similar. In his briefcase, he carried his Metalifton magna-ported 6-inch Colt Python 357 and Safariland speed loaders armed with Federal 158-grain semi-jacketed soft points. The case also contained the twin stainless Detonic Scoremaster 45s he liberated from the place, their spare magazines, as well as spare magazines for the twin stainless Detonic's combat masters in the double Alessi shoulder rig under his waist-length jacket. The briefcase was heavy. He walked the narrow, spotless sidewalks behind Evaman, Natalia, and his wife, Sarah. The three women were dressed to kill, and out, it would seem, for nothing but a casual stroll. How Evaman was armed, he did not know. Natalia carried her twin stainless L-frame 357s along with the silenced PPKS in the large leather-looking purse hanging from her left shoulder. He knew where the balisong was, under an improvised elastic garter inside her left thigh. Sarah carried the Trapper Scorpion she adopted between the night of the war and the time Rourke finally found his wife and two children. It was in her purse, and with it the battered, rust-pitted 1911 A1 she carried since the night of the war. Rourke stopped at a shop window. He spoke German better than he read it, but the books in the shop window all seemed to have been written by the leader or about the leader. Such books might soon become collector's items.
God damn. Not my taste in books.
Past his own smiling reflection, curiously superimposed over a poster of the very Hitler-like face of the leader, he could see the reflection of Wolfgang Mann, although he would not have recognized it. Mann wore a tight 25th century version of a business suit, the suit having seen better days, along with a white wig, false mustache, and a crushed cap. Mann's stooping shoulders and a cane accentuated the appearance of age. Mann's appearance was the most recognizable and therefore had to be altered. Mann carried a crumpled bundle under his arm. The bundle contained Mann's service pistol and a half dozen spare magazines. The cane was a sword, a relic preserved over 500 years from his ancestor who fought under Hitler against freedom. Now, if necessary, the blade would strike against Hitler's heir apparent in the cause of freedom. There was, after all, some poetry to life, John Rourke mused. He kept walking, watching ahead of him. The three women were further along because he stopped for a moment at the bookstore window. Eva Mann, Natalia, and Sarah were nearly to the exit of the complex. Sarah Rourke felt suddenly strange as she saw the reflection in the window of the dress shop. With Eva Mann and Natalia, she stopped to see the latest fashions offered to women of the complex. Somehow, seeing her own reflection in a shop window was different than seeing herself in a mirror. When she dressed in the clothes Eva Mann provided for her, she looked at herself in the mirror, and it all seemed unreal. There she stood in an expensive, well-made dress, fine heels, tasteful jewelry, with her hair up and wearing makeup. She had almost forgotten how it felt to wear lipstick, and now she wore eyeshadow as well. But seeing herself now with two other women doing something that had once been so perfectly normal, it frightened her. If her husband was successful here and the leader deposed, would there be warfare here? Would these women like Eva Mann and Helena Sturm, whom they were on their way to rescue, still have shop windows to gaze in? Could they still admire what they did not have, and perhaps more subtly admire what they already possessed in themselves? She considered her husband, John Rourke. They made love when she should have been at her most fertile. She wondered, almost happily, what if she was pregnant by him? What world would wait for their new child? Natalia, standing beside her, as exquisite a woman as Sarah had ever been, began again to walk. Sarah fell in step between Natalia and Eva Mann. She thought of herself as a thorn between two roses. Eva Mann, too, was exquisite. Natalia or Eva Mann, either of them could have been a model from the pages of Vogue. She tried to remember the last time she saw a copy of Vogue. She remembered. It was at the dentist's office when Annie chipped a baby tooth. If Sarah was pregnant, if it was a boy, all would be ideal for him. A Rourke, a natural leader like her husband, like her son. A man in a world where the manly virtues were what would make civilization take hold. But if it was a girl, she would be a woman who took civilization and made it stick after it had been planted. But this was not a world in which to be a woman, Sarah reflected as they neared the entrance to the complex. If Sarah was pregnant, would it force John to give up all hope of Natalia? Did she, Sarah, really want that? Sarah learned to live independent of John, to fend for herself. She learned to be her own person and not live under the shadow of his greatness and his strength. She found strength inside herself. Would she force him, through biological necessity, to be with her? What would he give up? What would she give up? Was it already given? But she loved him. John Rourke stopped again because the women stopped. He let Wolfgang Mann pass by. Rourke looked at cutlery in a shop window. He saw no knife he would trade for either his Gerber MK2 or his Sting 1A. He studied a display of what was apparently the contemporary counterpart of the Victorinox Swiss Army knives. Blades of all sizes, descriptions, functions.
Nothing for me today.
As he stood there, a thought crept into his mind. Had he made Sarah pregnant? Why did he make love to her? Because he still loved her. Of this he was certain. It was all that kept him sane during those times between the night of the war and when he found her. Now he wondered what she thought of him. John Rourke felt discomfort in the knowledge that those about him saw him as tireless, possessing courage without measure, a hero. He saw it in Paul's face, in Michael's face, in Annie's, in Natalia's eyes. He never considered himself more than ordinary, and in some ways less. Ever since childhood, he retreated into reticence. The reticence was interpreted as silent strength. His singularity of purpose was to avoid contemplating the alternative. That he planned ahead was his basic distrust in the efficacy of others. Confidence was a defense against the mass ineptitude of the world. He valued Paul, his courage, his understanding, and that rare love one man can show for another in friendship. Natalia was his friend as well, but more. She was more sensuous than Rourke ever imagined, but he had little more than touched her in all the time he had known her. Sarah and he were different, but they loved, had loved. He found himself staring at a hunting knife with plastic handles. Gone were stag or ivory. John Rourke began to walk. He faulted himself. Sarah was a fine and beautiful woman with strength and dignity and honor. Natalia was of equal character. If Sarah was pregnant, decision would be lost in honor. In John Rourke's mind, honor was what elevated men above the beasts. He kept walking. Sarah, Natalia, and Eva Mann had passed the guards at the open entrance to the complex. Natalia Anastasia Tyomarovna stopped. She stared at the edifice of the government headquarters for the youth. She stared obliquely, so her gaze would not attract attention. She felt her hands pressing down along her thighs, smoothing her dress. John, Sarah, they had been lovers again. She told John she was happy for them, and she was. Lying was something she abandoned long ago, and as one who had lived by deception, she could see truth. John Rourke loved her. John Rourke loved his wife as well. John was and always had been bound by duty. She, Natalia, would forever be John Rourke's bride, but only in her heart, never in fact. Natalia looked at Sarah Rourke. Sarah's eyes, her hair, her figure. She was a beautiful woman, but not the sort of woman who considered herself beautiful.
We should enter now, before we attract attention here.
Your English is so very good.
My husband, he taught it to me. It was his way of practicing when he trained for the officer corps. He was not my husband then, but...
Eva-man smiled, almost seeming to blush. Her pale cheeks reddened. Natalia's eyes met Sarah's eyes, and they shared a smile.
Ava's right. We should go inside.
Yes.
Natalia stepped out, her feet unused to heels after so long, but the discomfort was somehow worth it as she saw herself approaching the government building. Her reflection in the dark-tinted glass that covered almost the entire wall surface of the ground floor pleased her. Heels always did something for her, accentuated her height. Natalia knew she was beautiful. She had heard it often enough. She used it often enough.
I am very happy for you and for John.
Did John tell you?
He didn't have to tell me. I think after we have finished here and we have stopped Vladimir, my husband, I think I shall go away.
I don't want you to go away. That will solve nothing.
There is nothing that can be solved, Sarah. You are his wife.
He loves you as much as he loves me. Maybe more. Oh, I don't know. Yes, he made love to me, but I know he yearns to make love to you.
Thank you. He never has, I swear it.
It was sultry, the temperature and the humidity. Natalia was grateful the dress she wore was of a light fabric. The sun shone brilliantly. The grass that flanked the walkway leading toward the main entrance of the new government building was bright green and as neat as a freshly vacuumed carpet.
He is your man.
Is he?
Sarah quickened her pace. Natalia stopped for an instant, then she walked on, beginning to feel anxious. Once they were inside the building, it would begin. It always did. John Rourke approached the entrance to the complex.
A moment, mein Herr.
Yes. Is there something?
I have not seen your face before, sir.
Rourke smiled. His eyes felt the brightness of the sun beyond the entranceway. But he elected not to use his glasses because no one in the complex wore sunglasses.
I've seen you, Corporal. You're on duty weekdays from 8 until 4. I saw you once on Sunday. It is worthwhile to be observant, I suppose.
Yes, sir. What is in your briefcase?
Do you want to see boring things? I don't want to see them. Why don't you confiscate my briefcase and I can avoid all this paperwork and blame you instead, huh?
Go ahead, sir. I pity you the paperwork.
I pity you the standing.
Rourke turned and started ahead again. The AG Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome was up his right sleeve. A twist of his forearm would have sent the knife down into his palm. It was the corporal's lucky day. Rourke kept walking, the government building looming ahead of him now. It was imposing, if a bit overly utilitarian. He could just see, as he squinted against the light, Sarah, Natalia, and Eva Mann entering the building. Akira Kurinami ran his hand nervously along the receiver of the M16. Elaine Halverson watched him for an instant longer, then returned her gaze to the binoculars, through which she watched the area at the entrance to the complex. They secreted themselves with the enlisted personnel from Wolfgang Mann's party along a ridge in high jungle overlooking the entrance to the Nazi stronghold below.
Akira, what are you thinking?
What am I thinking? That this is a strange place for a Japanese naval aviator to be. In a jungle in Argentina, helping one faction of Germans fight against another.
Yes, this was strange. Akira, Elaine, and their colleagues spent 500 years sleeping to wake up to a new version of the worst of the 20th century. But there was more. It had been on Elaine's mind since the awakening, on many minds, she supposed, and it was like a time bomb, ticking. Soon, if the battling just to stay alive ended, then would what happened shortly after their launch into orbit sink in? It had already begun to with her.
I had a family, Akira. I mean, not a husband or children or anything, but I had a family. They're all gone.
A pretty woman such as you should have been married, I think.
She put down the binoculars.
I'm not pretty. And anyway, nobody asked. Well, there was a boy once. But I was working for a PhD, and I didn't really think it was all that urgent. And well, I thought there'd be plenty of time. I really did.
She studied his dark eyes. There was sadness in them.
I had a wife. I had two children. I did not volunteer for the International Corps of Astronauts. My government asked me. It was thought that it would bring honor to my country. Were I to pilot a manned craft that would someday touch the surface of another planet? Foolishly, I accepted the honor.
Well, I didn't.
My wife. She charmed my life. She was very quiet, very much what a Westerner such as yourself might consider a stereotypical Japanese woman. But she, I love her still. They were to come to America and join me. I found a house. It was a little Japanese-looking, and it had a garden. She would have liked it, I know. The children spoke English well, better than she. She would have learned it, though.
Akira looked away.
I know she would have.
Elaine Halverson tugged at her right earlobe, where Natalia had re-pierced her ears.
I envy you.
That my family is lost to me.
That you had them. The brash young man is just an act, isn't it? The reckless Japanese naval aviator.
I suppose so, Elaine. But there is no reason to be cautious.
She could not understand why, but she reached out her right hand and touched his left forearm. He did not draw his arm away. Instead, his right hand closed over hers. Rourke passed through the tinted glass of the doorway. A painting of the leader holding high the red, white, and black banner of Nazism and rising phoenix-like from a sea of flames dominated the far wall of the foyer. The ceiling was high, with a dark mirror finish. Stylistic metal sculptures hung at varying heights from its sweeping, swastika-embossed support beams. Near the painting, but not so near as to clutter the heroic visage, was a high desk. Two uniformed men, seemingly weaponless, but Rourke knew better from experience and from the counsel of Wolfgang Mann, stood behind it. They were interviewing a tattered old man. Rourke walked ahead toward the guard desk, noting the door to the ladies' room opening. Natalia stepped into the corridor first, followed by Sarah. Sarah seemed to be searching for something in her shoulder bag. Natalia's right hand was concealed behind her right thigh. Eva Mann joined them. The three women seemed to chatter in hushed tones. Rourke smiled. He was near enough to the guard desk to make out the conversation between the disguised Wolfgang Mann and the two guards.
I need to see Herr Gertler, supervisor of the youth. It is vital that I speak with him.
Herr Gertler does not see just anybody. You must move through proper channels and have an appointment. I shall be glad to give you his telephone number, and you can perhaps call tomorrow.
But I have walked all this way, from the far edge of the interior of the complex. It is so important.
Natalia swept up the silenced, stainless PPKS American in her right fist.
You are being very rude to one so old.
The guard nearest Natalia fell over dead before he could say another word. Rourke was beside the guard desk as the second body fell behind the desk. Wolfgang Mann had the paper bundle open on the desk. He drew his Walther-like service pistol and put the spare magazine into his pockets, throwing the empty bundle down over the desk and behind it. Sarah's right hand held the Trapper Scorpion 45. Natalia was changing magazines for the silenced PPKS. Rourke opened the briefcase, drew out his gun belt with the Milt Sparks six-pack for the twin stainless Teutonics Combat Masters, the full flap holster for the Python, the ammo dumps for it, the Gerber MK2. He secured the belt just below his waist, then took the Musette bag from the case. It held his spare magazines for the stainless Scoremasters and his speed loaders for the Python. He slung it crossbody. Last from the case were the two Scoremasters. He stuffed these in appendix forward carries right and left in the front of his gun belt. Rourke looked to Sarah. She held the second 45 in her left fist. He looked to Natalia. She looked slightly ridiculous, the double Safariland full-flap rig cinched at her waist. It didn't go with the dress, the jewelry, and the high heels. Eva Mann held a military pistol in her right fist, identical to her husband's.
Which way?
Rourke took the Sting 1A from his sleeve and sheathed it inside the waistband of his trousers.
Back along the corridor, and then either the elevator or the stairwell to the second basement. It is where she would be held.
Rourke nodded only, breaking into a run. He glanced at the black-faced Rolex on his left wrist. It would be more than an hour until the guard team at the front desk would be due for replacement, but anyone could come in at any time and discover their deaths. He passed the elevator banks, then slowed at the stairway door.
Natalia, check to see if there's an alarm. Hurry.
Natalia, running awkwardly in the heels and tight skirt, half skidded past him and dropped into a crouch before the door handle.
I can't be sure, but I don't think so.
Rourke nodded. Natalia stepped back. Rourke drew one of the Scoremasters from his belt, jacking back the slide, leaving the safety down. He turned the knob. There was no sound, which in itself proved nothing. Silent alarms would be no surprise here. Rourke stepped through the doorway, eyeing the frame first for any electronic surveillance. He looked above him, a camera eye. It moved, following him.
Kiss off secrecy.
He ran toward the steps leading to the basements, glancing behind him once. Natalia and Sarah were through, followed by Eva Mann, then Colonel Mann, behind his wife. The door slammed shut as Rourke led the group down the steps two at a time, the Scoremaster's safety upped.
No one can hear you. These walls are soundproofed, Fauststorm.
I know nothing!
Helena tugged at the straps restraining her wrists and ankles, binding her to the cold stainless steel of the surgical table. The four walls, the ceiling and floor all seemed made of stainless steel. She could not see her feet for the swollen abdomen and the life inside, the life for which she feared.
If my friend told you something, it was some sort of lie, Herr Gertler! I do know nothing!
Tears streamed along Helena's cheeks. Her vision blurred. She could taste the salt of her tears.
Liar! I am!
She heard the door open, and her heart skipped a beat. It was the face of the leader.
Fauststorm. Well, leave at once, Herr Gertler. My suspicions concerning a fifth column are confirmed. Armed men and women have invaded the structure. They will never get below the first basement, but I must leave. I have been watching the interrogation. It does not progress well.
Mein Führer, I am...
I can perhaps offer a suggestion.
Helena watched the leader's dark eyes, his nostrils twitching above the comedy brush mustache. His hand reached out to her abdomen, and he smiled as she felt the pressure there.
The child is kicking.
But perhaps they are twins, hmm?
Helena Sturm did not know what to answer, what to say that might not provoke him further.
There are several possibilities to get you to talk, mein Eva. Several. Your three boys. They are in the next room, bound, ready for whatever we should choose. But if we were to take the youngest son, what is young one's name? Willy? But if we were to take Willy, perhaps you would only lie. No. I think there is a better way.
His hand flashed down from her abdomen to her thighs, and she felt it. She could not see as he bunched up her skirt and reached.
Oh, what are you doing, my beloved?
The unborn within her, Herr Gertler. You shall have your surgeon prepare to probe the uterus.
The leader brought his face to within inches of Helena's frightened eyes. She could smell his breath, sour, somehow evil.
Perhaps, if there are twins, only one of them will be malformed by what is done here. It is your choice.
He smiled, his teeth yellow. She closed her eyes. A scoremaster in each hand, John Rourke dodged past the corner and fired, emptying the twin Detonix pistols toward the SS security troops at the far end of the corridor beyond the stairwell. Rourke tucked back beside Wolfgang Mann.
We must retreat before they send troops down the stairwell, and we are trapped!
Yeah, and what about this Helena Sturm? If they're working on her, they'll be working harder, no?
Rourke had already replaced the magazines and dropped the empties into his musette bag. Rourke drew the Python as he secured both 45s in his belt. Natalia was on her knees by the corner of the doorframe, firing her L-frames, wing shooting. She pulled back as automatic weapons fire hammered into the doorframe. Sarah reached to Avaman's hands.
Give me that pistol of yours. It's selective fire, isn't it?
Yes, a semi or three-burst shot, but the magazine is only 18 rounds, Frau Rourke.
How many spares you got?
John Rourke smiled.
One or two of us stays here with Eva's pistol set on burst, covering the others until they cross the opposite side of the corridor. Then you cover us with a second machine pistol.
And I'm the one. I never did run where the damn and heels in a tight skirt.
John Rourke looked at his wife.
I got a better way. Okay, Sarah and I stay here. Sarah with the space gun here. We cover the rest of you getting across. Then Sarah and I go out together while Natalia covers us. Colonel, you and Eva go on ahead. As soon as Sarah and I have crossed and linked up with Natalia, we'll be right behind you. Three-way firing maneuver, sorta.
It might work.
Mann nodded, stripping away the pieces of his disguise, chunks of clay-like substance shredding from his cheeks and the false goose flesh of his neck.
The secrecy is lost, I think.
Yeah, I just hope that the way out of this place isn't lost.
Mann's wife searched her purse and gave Natalia the double-column magazines. Rourke counted three.
Set is all I have.
Ibaman's skin paled. Her eyes seemed to sink. Fear. Rourke knew the look.
Good luck to both of you.
Natalia gave the magazines to Sarah, who stuffed them into the side seam pockets of her dress.
It ruins the look of things.
This is the position for burst control. It is a two-position safety, slide-mounted.
Right, put it here. All the way down into the lower notch?
That is correct, Frau Rourke.
Move it then, when Sarah says go.
Rourke held the Python in both fists, muzzle raised to snap it around the corner of the shot-up doorframe. Sarah held the Walther-like German pistol, her right hand at the pistol grip, her left at the folded-down forward support. The gun on auto mode reminded Rourke of the Beretta 93R.
Go!
Natalia dashed across the corridor, firing at the SS, while Rourke and Sarah opened up from the doorway. Mann darted across the opening, pushing his frightened, barefoot wife ahead of him, his pistol firing toward the SS position as well. The Python empty, Rourke dropped it in the leather at his side and drew both scoremasters from his belt as Sarah reloaded. Two SS men dodged from cover to get into better position to fire at Natalia as she dove behind cover on the opposite side, halfway along the corridor. Rourke leveled both pistols. The scoremasters were empty. Rourke rammed them into his belt, the slide still locked open. Sarah, beside him again, fired the German machine pistol in three-round blasts.
One more after this, John!
The twin stainless Detonix 45s were empty in his hands. Rourke dumped the magazines, pocketed the empties, and rammed fresh spares up the magazine wells from the Milt Spark six-pack at his belt.
Run for it! Now! I'm with you!
Natalia stepped from cover to draw fire. Her reloaded revolvers at hip level spit death. Rourke threw himself forward, hitting the floor, skidding along on knees and elbows into cover, both pistols empty in his hands as he rolled onto his back.
John!
He was up to his feet. Sarah emptied the German machine pistol as she dove into the corridor next to John.
We're clear for the moment.
Rourke looked to Sarah and saw blood on her left forearm. He pulled up her sleeve.
I've never been... Oh, Jesus! It hurts!
That's a flesh wound.
Rourke felt the arm for any broken bone. With his left hand, he reached into the musette bag for a field dressing.
I'll do it, John.
Natalia dropped to her knees beside him.
I'm fine. Oh, hurts like the devil. But I'm okay.
Sarah tried to get to her feet.
Rest a moment. Let me get this dressing secure.
Rourke stood as Natalia attended his wife's arm. Eva Mann cradled Sarah's head in her lap. Mann was going over the bodies of the dead, scrounging weapons and magazines. Rourke rammed fresh magazines up the butts of his pistols, working the slides forward.
Clean wound. Bullet just made a heavy crease.
Natalia used one of the aerosol sprays Dr. Munchen sent with them. Munchen explained it not only promoted significantly more rapid healing, but served as a disinfectant as well.
Almost ready?
Rourke dropped to his knees beside Natalia, reached out with his left hand. He touched his left hand to his wife's forehead.
You know, you've gotten pretty damn good in a fight.
You're not bad yourself.
Rourke bent over his wife and kissed her lightly on the lips.
You gonna be all right? We gotta get moving.
Fine. Just took me by surprise.
Yeah, bullets always do.
I'll stay with her.
Rourke stood and looked at Natalia. There were things he wanted to say to Natalia, to Sarah.
I have 5 more of the machine pistols, as you call them. 2 assault rifles for each of us. More additional magazines than we can carry.
I can carry quite a lot.
Rourke took 2 of the assault rifles, checked their condition of readiness, and slung them cross-body. He preferred his own weapons. He looked to his wife. Natalia was just finishing securing the dressing.
Sarah, can you still handle one of these?
Natalia drew back for a moment. Sarah flexed her left arm.
Yeah. Don't ask me to do it tomorrow, though.
Natalia continued securing the dressing. Mann crouched beside Sarah and began dropping spare magazines for the German pistol into her purse. Together, Rourke and Natalia helped Sarah to her feet.
Oh!
Natalia picked up 2 of the assault rifles, checked their condition of readiness, then took 1 of the German pistols. As they walked down the corridor, Natalia began reloading her revolvers and reholstered them. They started down the hall, and it was only as he turned to make sure they were all together that Rourke noticed Natalia's dress. She apparently used her knife and slit the skirt for better freedom of movement. She slit the slip as well. Eva Mann clutched a machine pistol in both hands. Her husband carried 2 of the assault rifles slung cross-body and a 3rd in his hands. Rourke edged past Wolfgang Mann, taking point as they moved along the corridor. It would be a matter of moments until more of the SS personnel flooded the corridor, but at least, Rourke reflected, the 5 of them were better equipped now. He could see the pain in Sarah's eyes, but she held the pistol ready as she walked. The purse, slung cross-body, sagged heavily at her left side. Rourke swung 1 of the assault rifles forward. According to Wolfgang Mann's plan, the doorway ahead opened on a stairwell to the next level below.
I will go first. Perhaps if there are regular troops, I can reason with them.
Yeah, maybe.
Rourke glanced behind them along the corridor. No one stirred. Rourke positioned himself beside the door. Mann reached out and turned the knob. The door swung in. They waited. Mann stepped through, his rifle preceding him, the muzzle moving right and left, up and down, like a snake searching out prey.
It is clear, my friends.
Eva Mann started after him.
Wait, Schatzi. Let Herr Doctor follow me.
Rourke stepped through the doorway. It was a single stair rather than the dual stairway from the first floor. Mann was already moving down. Rourke followed after the German colonel slowly, peering down the stairwell, waiting. There would be security personnel on the other side of the door, he reasoned.
No! I know nothing!
Herr Gertler bent over her. Large medical forceps of gleaming stainless steel in his hairy right hand.
I will do this myself, Fausto, unless you tell me everything I wish to know. We know a 5th column exists. We have known this for some time. And from our informant...
Manfred!
Her son stood quietly at her head.
We know that Eva Mann, the wife of the Standartenführer, he's somehow involved in the conspiracy as well. But I will make it easy on you and your unborn children.
Merely tell us that Eva Mann is involved in the conspiracy and you shall be unharmed, as fills the lives you carry in your womb. We can obtain all the information beyond this when Eva Mann is interrogated. Now, admit to us that she is involved in this conspiracy. That her husband is the leader.
No!
Otherwise, Faustum.
Gertler brandished the forceps. Then she could no longer see them.
I shall be forced to do something, mein Frau, that we shall all regret.
She felt a contraction, her baby's.
If my babies die, it's better. Better than living in this society. Where men like you.
Her uterus contracted. Then she felt cold steel against her flesh. John Rourke watched the movement at the base of the stairwell. Three of the SS security men came through the doorway from the main corridor of the second basement. With a flurry of fists, elbows, and knees, Rourke left the three guards lifeless on the cold concrete floor. Natalia vaulted the stairwell and was beside him, the German machine pistol in her hands. Rourke swung the assault rifle at his right side forward on its sling, wrenched the partially open door past a dead man's left foot, then stepped slowly into the corridor. No one there. Rourke started ahead. Natalia, barefoot beside him, her stride as long as his. Rourke glanced back once at Wolfgang Mann, Sarah, and Eva Mann. Sarah turned half around, covering the stairwell as they moved along the corridor, deeper into the bowels of the second basement.
The interrogation room should be at the end of the corridor. There's a questioning room, quite comfortable, and then a second room beyond it. It is supposedly an emergency medical facility, but for some time there have been rumors of hideous experiments performed there by Herr Gertler and the youth. If they have Eva Sturm's children, they're likely in the outside room.
We can go in together. I will protect the boys.
I'll take out any guards not directly threatening them. Then we rush the second room very fast.
Agreed.
Get Sarah to back us up. Once we hit the second room, she keeps the boys safe if we find them.
Right.
They reached the door. There was no time to worry if it was locked. Rourke's rifle blew the lock plate. He kicked the door inward with his left foot. Natalia followed him as he looked right. Rourke saw three men and a tall, thin, effeminate-looking boy, a cigarette hanging from his gaping mouth. Rourke emptied both assault rifles into the three men. The boy picked up one of the German machine pistols. Natalia's machine pistol cut down the boy. Rourke saw, cowering on the floor, three wide-eyed little boys looking less than 2 years apart in age, their bodies stripped of all clothing, then tied with what looked like wire with stickball gags in their mouths.
Goddamn animals. Sarah, Eva, come help these children.
Rourke, twin scoremasters in hand, Natalia beside him, the twin Metalife custom revolvers in her hands, turned to the door leading to the interior room. The door had a large knob. Rourke stuffed one of the pistols under his right armpit, cocked and locked. He grabbed the doorknob with his left hand. He turned the stainless steel knob, the feeling of the steel cold like death. The door was free. There before him writhed a woman, her clothes bunched up to her crotch, her abdomen huge as she lay on a steel surgical table. A man leaned over her with forceps. Another dropped lit matches onto her face as she screamed.
Bastards!
Rourke's scoremaster fired into the body of the man with the forceps. Rourke shifted the muzzles, a shot from each pistol, blowing out the eyes of the man dropping the matches into Helena Sturm's face. Rourke shifted again as the boy picked up a surgical knife and swung it downward toward Helena Sturm's throat. Rourke's pistols fired again into the right forearm, nearly severing it. The knife clattered harmlessly to the blood-drenched table surface. Natalia emptied her machine pistol as the boy's body pirouetted, stumbled, collapsed against the wall behind, and sagged downward, trailing streaks of blood on the dully gleaming stainless steel.
Manfred! Mein Gott, Manfred!
Vladimir Karamazov left his machine, feeling the warmth of the Argentine sun on his face. It was nearly sundown. He held hat in hand and then thought better of what it should perhaps suggest to his officers. He replaced it on his head, broadened his stride as he drew nearer to Krakowski and Antonovich. The two majors strode toward him as well. They would intersect, he judged, at almost the exact center of the broad, grassy plain serving as the helicopter landing field. The jet landing field lay on the opposite side of a range of low, grassy hills to the west. He stopped walking, so his field officers would have to approach him. Krakowski and Antonovich continued walking, stopping a few feet from him, simultaneously raising their right hands in salute. Vladimir Karamazov returned the salutes.
Gentlemen, the potential for great victory lay before us. At dawn, our forces shall be properly assembled, and we shall assault with full intensity this Nazi stronghold. Ground troops, helicopter gunships, jet fighter aircraft. I believe the Nazis coined the term Blitzkrieg. And this it shall be.
Major Antonovich nodded.
All is in readiness, Comrade Colonel. I have seen to it that surveillance data, photographs, revised maps, all are being properly disseminated to line commanders. Gunships are being programmed with the topographic features of the Nazi stronghold and its environs even as we speak, Comrade Colonel.
Karamazov turned to accept the report of Krakowski. He disliked the younger of his two majors.
Comrade Colonel, the jet fighter craft under my command are refueling. Their weapons consoles are being programmed with Comrade Major Antonovich's data even as we speak. My gunship crews are preparing their machines for battle. The ground forces are moving into their staging areas. All is in readiness, but for your command.
Karamazov studied the young major with a penchant for poetry.
Excellent. You have both performed admirably. And it shall be reported so to the Central Committee. Victory over the entire Earth shall be mine.
Akira Kurinami and one of Mann's men, a Private Gessler, had moved back from the overlook of the complex, taking the steep, dusty trail that Mann explained was carved from the jungle for just such a troop movement. Kurinami didn't envy a soldier moving upward along it with a full pack. He pushed his hair back from his eyes, shifting the M16 to his left hand. Gessler spoke no English, and Kurinami spoke no German. He hadn't even entertained the thought of conversing in Japanese, for Gessler to have known it would have been as likely as Gessler knowing ancient Aramaic. They signaled intentions instead by hand and arm signals. Now Gessler did just that. Kurinami stopped and edged back slightly. He heard movement as well. Kurinami shifted the M16 to a hard assault position, his thumb finding the selector and moving it to full auto. A uniformed man broke from the jungle cover where the road took a bend. Kurinami raised the gun to fire. The uniform was German, and the face, more importantly, was one he recognized. The officer under the command of Wolfgang Mann, who traveled with them. The private, Gessler, came to attention and did a rifle salute. The German officer, Hauptsturmfuhrer Hartmann, returned Gessler's salute. And then Hartmann saluted Kurinami politely.
Lieutenant Kurinami, all is in readiness.
Kurinami saluted, and Hartmann dropped his hand.
Captain, Elaine Haverson, myself, and the remainder of the Colonel Mann's force have been observing the complex. There seemed to be considerable troop movement toward what we understand is the new government building. We detected what might have been gunfire, but there has been no signal from Colonel Mann.
Then I suggest that we continue with the Standart and Führer and Herr Doctor's plan as originally set forth. I shall move with my men into position. The bulk of my force is already moving up. We have, however, unfortunate news. Monitoring of radio signals from North America indicates that Hauptsturmfuhrer Sturm acted independently of his orders. After suffering a significant defeat at the hands of the Russians, upon returning and realizing that the Standartenfuhrer returned to Argentina, he attacks the Standartenfuhrer's remaining forces. The Hauptsturmfuhrer then proceeded to attack the Eden Project site. Hauptsturmfuhrer Helmut Sturm. He's a good officer. But, unfortunately, he is also a dedicated Nazi. Among the most dedicated. But we idle here, I think, too long. Shall we?
Kurenami shifted the selector of his assault rifle back to safety. As he started back up along the road, walking at Hartman's left, he could not help but wonder how many of the Eden personnel were dead. They survived 500 years of cryogenic sleep to rebuild a world, but now were senselessly slaughtered.
Stupid.
The trail was steep and long ahead, and he was already tired. Madison drew the shawl tighter about her shoulders. Despite the coat beneath her wrap, the cold bit deep. She thought it was not just the temperature, but fear. Concealed under her right palm was the small Derringer pistol Paul gave her to use. A raw cold wind gusted along the plain now, the wind riding up under her skirt, billowing it and chilling her legs. She kept walking. She could see the two Eden Project personnel beside Father Rourke's camouflage-painted pickup truck. She forced her mind elsewhere. She thought of the baby. She was certain she carried life within her, life given her by Michael, life she would return to him. When she and the others were taken off by the evil Russian man, she craved death for herself and the baby. She thought Michael was dead. Michael, the man who gave more life to her than the life that would soon swell within her. Her left hand, the right held the Derringer, felt at her body. Madison raised her head, throwing her hair back into the wind, setting a smile on her face. Michael and Paul told her what to do, but she had her own ideas. She hoped they would work. One of the men in white coveralls and green coat, Eden personnel, turned from leaning against the truck.
What can we do for you, miss? This truck is off limits to your family.
Oh, please. I need something from inside the truck.
Well, what is it you need, miss? We'll get it for you.
Madison shortened her steps to make them appear more hesitant, to make herself appear more fearful than she really was, though she was afraid.
It's a very personal thing that I need. It's very small.
She hadn't figured out what it was yet, but that wasn't important. Women, as she quickly learned from the girl she considered like a sister, Annie Rourke, always had very personal things, and men were always eager to know about them.
I'm sorry, miss. If you can't tell me, then you'll have to take it up with Captain Dodd, okay?
Madison stopped 6 feet or so from him, smiling embarrassedly.
But I really need it. Can I tell just you? If I really have to? Can I whisper it to you, sir?
She had learned also that men liked flattery. The man she spoke to looked at the second man, shrugged his shoulders, then nodded his head.
Okay. What can I do for you, miss?
She approached him, looking at the ground as though studying her boots. She stopped directly before him. He was very tall.
May I whisper it in your ear, please? I'm very, well, embarrassed.
Fine.
The man bent slightly forward. Madison raised on her tiptoes. She touched her left hand to his shoulder as she brought her lips close to his left ear.
What the?
I will shoot you. It's already cocked. And the caliber is .45. Drop your rifle and tell your friend that he should please do the same.
Oh, shit.
She watched his eyes flicker. Hers didn't.
Drop your gun, Harry.
Now lie down on the ground. Both of you.
She had one of the duplicate sets of keys Father Rourke wisely prepared for his fine truck. She gathered the Eden Guard's rifles, slung one over her shoulder, and pointed the other at the prone men. With an M16 still pointed at the prostrate Eden Project men, Madison shifted the truck into drive.
Thank you both so very much.
Son of a bitch!